at about 9:30, the city was plunged into darkness by a power cut. At least, he presumed it was about 9:30, and that the city had been plunged into darkness. There was no clock in his cell, and indeed, no view of the city. He only knew that the light in the corridor died. For a moment, darkness enveloped him. Then his eyes adjusted, and the night sky became visible through the window. Calling it a window was generous. It was a barred, glassless hole, and nothing could be seen through it, except the sky. Nonetheless, he was exceptionally grateful to this window, first, for the fresh air, and second, because it allowed him to see the stars. When he had first come here, he had dreaded the nights. The damp, the loneliness, the cold and horrid rustling of insects. Then, gradually, the night had become his refuge. When left alone, he would often sleep during the day and lie awake at night. Sometimes he would spend all night watching stars traversing the window. There they were, those tiny gold lights, telling him that millions and billions of miles away, all kinds of life, electrical, physical, chemical, possible, burnt in joyous abandon, carelessly flinging light across the universe. Whatever he did, whatever anyone else did, those lights just kept on burning. It was the most reassuring thing he had ever thought or felt in his tiny, pathetic existence. Now, in the distance, a door slammed. He tensed instantly, long attuned to signs of danger. There was a voice shouting, and the door at the end of the corridor was unbolted with a clang. A flicker of light swayed outside the cell door. He got up immediately and changed corners. He did not like them to notice that he looked at the sky, in case they deemed to take it away from him. The door banged open. Outside stood two guards, and someone he had never seen before, a fat man in a uniform lumpen with braid. The fat man was carrying a torch and sweating. He stepped into the cell, staggering slightly. "The electrician, sir," said one of the guards. "His name is Ishmael." "The electrician," hissed the fat man, as if this was an accusation. Ishmael could see the shine on his boots and the gun in his belt. He stunk of alcohol. He shone the torch in Ishmael's face, forcing him to look away. The guards dragged the machine through the doorway. Ishmael told himself he was no longer afraid, and in a way, it was true. His brain no longer registered terror. But his body seemed to generate fear by itself, and now began to jerk and spasm. Cold sweat covered him. The guards began to set up the equipment, a jerry-rigged piece of machinery involving car batteries and gaffer-taped switches. Sometimes, in moments of obscene humour, he thought of writing to the United Nations and complaining that he was being tortured by cack-handed amateurs. Somebody pulled his face back. He found himself looking up at the uniformed man. Coils of sweat adorned the man's face. "You," spat the fat man, "you are an electrician. Why is there no electricity?" He said nothing. It was better to say nothing. At the beginning he talked wildly and quickly and hopelessly, trying to explain that he was just a humble electrical engineer. He tried to explain that all he'd done was write a report about the wiring in the new hospital, which he'd had to describe as grossly substandard. He tried to explain that he hadn't known that it had been built by the company owned by the president's wife. He tried to explain that it wasn't him who had passed the report to the foreign journalists who made the unfortunate documentary which led to the aid donors stopping the money which the president had been depending on to buy the new limousines. He tried to tell them that he wasn't a separatist, terrorist, fundamentalist, communist, or a homosexualist, but they weren't interested in any of it. He had learnt quickly that the point of torturing him was not, as one might have expected, to make him talk. On the contrary, the point of torturing him was to take him to a place where he was incapable of speech, spitting and wreathing on the ground. Then they would be satisfied, half-heartedly, in a sordid way. The fat man seized the ragged lapels of Ishmael's shirt and shoved his face closer. A stench of rum enveloped him, reminding him of puddings his mother used to make. Ishmael found himself lifted up by the collar. Then the fat man dropped him on the floor, jarring his teeth. Why, said the fat man very slowly, has there been a power cut? Why is there no electricity? Why are the drinks not cold? He let out a howl, as if of deep primeval grief. You are just an electrician, just an electrician, just an electrician, sang the fat man, like he was singing a lullaby. You are nothing, you are nobody, but you think you can mess with us. Do you know who I am? Do you know who I am? At this point, Ishmael made the mistake of shaking his head slightly. Or maybe it was just some involuntary spasm of tension. The fat man's eyes popped, spittle foamed on his mouth. Hurriedly, the guards began priming the machine, connecting wires and flicking switches. The machine began to hum and shake and judder slightly, as if it smelt blood. Get out, said the fat man, and the guards retreated, leaving the door open. The fat man balanced his torch on top of the machine, facing upwards. His shadow loomed across the cell. He picked up the electrical leads. Well, he muttered. Well? He lurched forward, and Ishmael felt the charge hit him. He felt his mouth come open, his arms launch themselves as if in some hope of escape, his legs flail emptily. His head banged against the wall. For a second, or longer, all air was forced out of his body, and his lungs were paralysed. The pressure built up and up, and the terror of death, for a moment, rode him. Then it stopped. Small, grunting, moaning noises came out of his mouth. Gradually the walls reasserted themselves in their right order, the floor, the ceiling. He wanted to see the window, to look out at the stars, but he lay on the floor, lacking strength to move. Concrete pressed into his temple. There was a grunting, scratching noise close to his head. He opened his eyes. The torch had fallen over, and the fat man was on his hands and knees. In one hand, he held one of the electrical leads, while the other he scrabbled around on the floor. Behind him, the machine still buzzed faintly. Slowly, a thought crossed Ishmael's mind. It crossed as slowly as the stars crossed the window. Didn't these people understand? Didn't they know about Earth and live and currents? Didn't they know that power was dangerous and should be treated with respect? Ishmael opened his mouth, but he wasn't sure whether it was to protest, or to warn him, or simply to dribble like an imbecile onto the concrete. The fat man's grasping hand caught hold of something. He made a strange noise, and his teeth started to chatter. He grunted and shuddered. Then, like a stunned pig, he collapsed. Nothing moved. A terrifying rattle began to exit from his innards. Then he went silent. Ishmael could hear the machine still buzzing. He could hear himself breathing. In the corner, the torch kept burning. He wasn't sure how long he lay there. At last, he got up, leant on the wall, and went to fetch the torch. He shone it in the fat man's face. His tongue bulged from his mouth, and his eyes popped wildly. Ishmael prodded him. With a chink, the fat man's jacket slid back from his enormous belly, revealing a bunch of keys. Ishmael picked up the keys. He stared at them. They swung slightly in his hand. He looked out of the window. The stars were still there. Carefully, he removed the wires from the fat man's hands. He turned off the machine. He undid the dead man's clothes. He shivered in the dead man's shirt, still damp from his sweat. He pulled in the belt, but there were no notches small enough for his half-starved frame. The trousers hung around him like curtains, and the shoes rattled around his feet. He took the keys in one hand and the torch in the other. The corridor was pitch black. He turned off the torch and felt his way. At the end, the door was locked. He fumbled, terrified of the clinking keys. But at last a key fitted, and he opened the door. Another, then another. It clanked as a series of locks gave way. He stepped out into the lightless prison compound. The guard post was illuminated by a single hurricane lantern. He walked purposefully across to the front gate, keeping the cap low over his face. The shoes flipped like clown shoes around his feet. He searched for the keys, fumbling in the darkness. One lock gave. Two, three, four. The door swung open. He stepped through, into the outside. The door clicked into place behind him. He began to jog along the road, gravel beneath his feet. He waited for the sound of bells, of alarms, of sirens. None came. He dropped to a walk, passing the darkened houses. He walked and walked and walked. Blisters grew on his feet. Where should he go? Not home. He probably didn't even have a home anymore. He couldn't go to friends or anyone he knew. He passed out, beyond the houses, onto a great spare space where piles of rubbish and stray dogs roamed. Before him lay the great slum. The slum was not dark. Fires burnt and generators pumped in illegal drinking dens. Lanterns glowed in the windows. Somewhere in the slum must be a church, a priest or minister who would protect him. He began to limp forward, avoiding the lights from the bars, the cars that hovered around them. He dived into a dark alley. He knew the city well, but he did not know his way here. No one did. The slum changed every week, growing and shifting like an amoeba. He turned left, right again. In the darkness, he startled two women, who fled, whispering. He realized he was still wearing the uniform and that it would be most unwelcome here. He went on and on. Weariness began to drag him down. The weight of his bones increased, and the ground began to seem so very, very inviting. He loved that ground, that earthy, broken ground, and he wanted to lay his head on it. He wanted to lay on the ground and die, so his bones would stop hurting. He came out on a corner. In a tin shack, two women brewed coffee. He looked at them and realized he had forgotten how to converse with a human being. He opened his mouth. He took off his hat. The women recoiled, as if they saw something wrong in his face. Where is the church? He managed to say. The women pointed to a lane behind him. The lane went uphill. It was the hardest, longest uphill of his life. Stones sought to trip him up. Walls swayed and bulged. His knees tried to buckle beneath him. At last, he became aware of the church tower, a white, blocky thing that loomed out of the darkness. A long wall ran ahead, with no sign of a door. He put out a hand, like a blind man, and began to follow the wall. He turned a corner. Two men stood before him. They froze, their faces a picture of horror. They clutched a lantern and paintbrushes, bucket and papers. For a second they stared at him, then, as if by agreement, bolted. He realized he was still carrying the torch. He turned it on and surveyed the clumsily printed posters pasted to the church wall. The posters were a rough screen print of a man staring hopefully and determinedly into a better future. He stared at the posters. They were all the same, and they were all himself. Gradually, the battery faded and the torch died. The night swallowed him. Above him, the stars blazed like 1,000 lanterns dancing across the sky, endlessly, helplessly blazing.